Facebook, Google, all of these companies are trying to figure out where are the rules and where are they going to draw the line.
There's clearly a demand for renters. They've got most of them full.
If you own a bond in your retirement portfolio, the price of that is going to go down.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
Hi, welcome to Thursday afternoon. Steve Bertrand here in the Allstate Skyline studio. Let's jump right into it. Ian Schur is a senior editor at CNET.com and joins us on most Thursdays anyway, and he is on the phone line now. Ian, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. We're a little short, so I want to just jump right into all of this. You know, I was talking about in the crosstalk about this Amazon Key or Key by Amazon, the idea that the Amazon delivery guy would have access to your house or your car to drop off your packages. People laughed at it. But they're expanding it, right? And it's interesting to me that they want to make this a program not just for package delivery.
Yeah, I think first off that it is a sign of the future. I think that, you know, when you think about how every holiday season people post these videos of package thieves, and there's just this kind of, as we move more and more to an e-commerce-based life, regardless of how it affects retail or the environment or anything else, there needs to be solutions for easier ways to get us the packages, especially if people aren't home or whatever else. So this is all very logical. The thing is, I think Amazon's way ahead of the curve. They're doing this at a time when people are still not comfortable with it, which is why it gets mocked.
Right.
You know, I feel weird about someone going into my car or home, but you know, it's expanding. People apparently use it.
I really don't. I would have no problem with someone dropping off something in my car or even my house, I think. So the idea is if you're Amazon Prime or whatever, and then you would buy this gizmo, right? That you'd have to have an internet locking system or something that would allow them to come in.
Yeah, and it's a really, I mean, there are other companies trying to do this. There are a number of smart lock companies that will allow you to basically give someone access to your home for a short amount of time. So let's say you have a cleaner or a dog walker.
Right.
You could actually tell their phone, hey, you have access for this amount of time, and then their app on that phone would allow you to get them into the home.
But,
which is, by the way, where Amazon's also planning to go eventually. They want to allow home cleaners and dog walkers and repairmen into your home as well using Amazon's technology. And look, if it continues to be something people enjoy, I think it's gonna end up taking off. And part of the way that they're doing this is they got a camera to look at it, so you feel more comfortable. I mean, there's a lot of logical things they're doing here.
Right, and so that's what I sort of alluded to, that it would spread beyond, so that your maid service would not have a key to your house anymore. They would use this to get in and out, and you could watch him or her while she was cleaning your house.
Yeah, or a family member who's in town for a short amount of time. I when I have a lot of family in town, we seem to lose keys really quick. So
a
lot of these.
How about this, Ian? A cable guy.
Right.
You know, so you're
exactly.
Not sitting there for 4 hours. Okay, so there's that. Let's go to facial recognition software. And there's this kid suing Apple for $1 billion because he said that they used facial recognition software on a store. He was wrongfully accused of stealing from these stores. And so now he wants $1 billion?
Yeah, and I mean, obviously he's trying to make a statement here. But this this teenager says that, you know, he was wrongfully accused. Apple, for what it's worth, suggests that it doesn't use facial recognition software in its stores. So
for what it's worth,
law enforcement.
Yeah, that's a denial. For what it's worth, they say they don't do it, right?
Yeah, and I think that what's going on here is that this is a larger conversation about law enforcement. I think that if you look around the world, more and more countries are using it. It's popular in the UK. Of course, China, there's a lot of stories that we've written on CNET about the systems that they've built to facial recognize everybody. And I think part of the problem here is that all of the surveys we've found so far find that it's not very effective. There's a lot of false positives. And I think this teenager in particular might be a really good sign of that.
But the other side of it, though, Ian, is that it's not like they picked him out of the blue just from the pictures, right? This thief, the real thief, was using an ID stolen from this kid.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, but what's interesting is that as well, according to the lawsuit that was filed, we don't have Apple's response yet. According to the lawsuit, the cop immediately realized from that this person that he was going after was not the same person who had done the stealing. So, you know, it's kind of like one of those things of, oh, mistaken identity. It's not like he was thrown in jail and he was in there for years or whatever. And I'm not diminishing. I mean, still having a cop come at you and accuse you
right.
of a crime is very uncomfortable and not okay. And I think it's really good that we're having this conversation, and it's going to be interesting to see, you know, Apple's probably going to pass the buck if they're not responsible, and that means that the law enforcement people will be on the hook, and that'll be interesting.
Hey, have you heard about this Avengers Endgame movie that's coming out?
What is that? I don't know what you're talking
about.
Okay,
I'm not kidding you. I saw Deadpool. That's the only comic book movie I've ever seen in my life.
Not even in the same universe.
And so this game is coming out, and there's a piece at CNET by Abrar Al-Hiti, I'll say, and he sat there for 59 hours, or he's in the midst of a 59-hour sit-through watching all the Marvel movies. That's pretty funny.
Yeah, she's actually, lucky for us. Yeah, there's actually a place just down the street from our office who's doing this crazy marathon. It started on April 23rd. It ends today with the Endgame movie. And she had only seen a couple of movies. She'd seen, I think it was Spider-Man Homecoming and one other because everyone had told her to. But she really wasn't much of a fan of this stuff. And so we thought, oh, perfect person to torture with 59 hours of these movies.
Wow.
And she's had a blast. I mean, I don't know if you've been, you should see what she's been tweeting. You know, she's actually met some of the people who are there. The theater's nearly full, which is also an amazing thing to me. Like, what do these people have this time for?
So does it end today?
Yes, it ends today with the actual, like, the real Avengers Endgame film, which will be showing at 5 p.m. here in San Francisco. If anyone's taking a flight today, it's at the Metreon down in downtown. You guys can watch it with her.
Ian Scherer, thanks for stopping by. Have a great week. We'll talk again next week.
Absolutely.
It's 12:21. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank, and we thank them for that. Bill Geiger's in the studio from Geiger Wealth Management. Our regular conversations with Bill are sponsored by Geiger Wealth Management, Chicago's retirement planning experts. Bill, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Good to be here. It seems like a while.
I know. I haven't seen you in a while.
Baseball games have been going on.
I think that's it. The weather is broken. I think summer might be coming, actually.
Cross your fingers.
All right. So people come into your office. They get ready for retirement, right? What is it that a couple is helping for retirement? What is it that the really important thing that they need to get right when it comes time to setting a goal?
Steve, we spend a really good amount of time working on income because it's so important in retirement. We had a couple in the other day. It was their third meeting. We just wrapped up their financial plan. And the really important things coming out of it were, when were they going to be able to retire? How long was their money going to last? How much money they were going to have? How much income they were going to have to live on in retirement? And if you think about it, income kind of makes the world really go round in retirement. And when these folks left, they kind of had those questions answered.
And that's what we keep talking about over and over, right? It's not just having a big chunk of savings somewhere. It's creating income that will be coming in for you every month.
Yeah, you take that big pile of savings and you convert that into something that you're going to need or into a framework for you to live your life in retirement.
Right.
That big stack of money somehow has got to be converted into income. Somehow you got to figure out how to pay your bills each month. And that's what we spend an awful lot of time on doing, is setting that up for people.
And that's the beauty of it, right? Because once it's set up, and if it's set up well, you can rely on it. There's going to be income coming into you.
Yeah, when you stop working, the paychecks stop, right? So you really need a replacement for that. You need income coming in each month to replace your paychecks. And at the end of the day, when we work on this, we kind of end up with effectively a private pension plan, if you will. Think of a pension. The checks come every month, right?
Right, right.
Well, imagine taking part of your portfolio and creating that for yourself. That's what kind of lights people up.
You know, we were talking earlier this week about Social Security and when to take it and all of that. And, you know, I'm curious what you think, because I just sat through a meeting, you know, and the financial people most say put it off for as long as you can. Is that your view, too?
It kind of depends.
Because I'm thinking, wait, I don't want, what if I die first?
Well, you're not going to know anyhow.
Yeah, okay.
Because you're going to be dead, right?
Right, okay, yeah.
Okay, but it kind of depends. If you are retiring early, early, like at 62 or before, it might make sense to take the money out of your Social Security rather than taking it out of your portfolio to live on.
And why would that be? Because you're going to be taking it for a longer period of time?
Well, it's just if you take money out of your portfolio is going down from day one, right? If you take it out of Social Security, your portfolio is not going to decrease by that amount. We got to run the numbers. We've got software that does all this great stuff. And when people tell us when they want to retire, and we understand their portfolio size, and we understand their Social Security, you can back into this. But it's not a one-size-fits-all.
And that's what comes into your retirement plan, right, when you create a retirement plan for people. What's involved with that?
Well, people walk out of our office, Steve, with a one-page, we call it Geiger Wealth Retirement Income Plan. It's where their money is going to come from every year for the next 30 years for the rest of their life. And there's so many different components in there, and Social Security is one of them, obviously.
Right.
Creating income for yourself is another. How long you're going to work is another.
I think the hardest part is coming up with the monthly amount of money that you're going to need.
You're right.
Because, you know, there are some static costs, but it's the elastic costs. I don't know if that's the right term, but it's the elastic costs that are sort of hard to come up with. And, you know, the last thing you want to do is retire too soon and be always worried about how much you're going to spend every month.
That's the last thing you want to do in retirement is to be worried. And if you have enough income coming in each month, you can sleep at night.
So how do you figure out what you're going to need?
Here's the quick, easy, dirty way from the top down, Steve. You add up how much money hits your checking account from your job every month. After the 401k, after taxes, what's actually deposited?
Okay.
Write that number down. And then underneath that, write how much you're saving every month.
Okay.
And subtract one from the other, and that's how much
you're spending. Right.
Yeah. And I do that with folks, and they go, well, we're really not saving anything. I said, well, that's right. What your lifestyle
right.
costs.
Right. And so then you want to retire and be able to, is it 80%, 75%, 110% of that figure?
It's 100%
easy. It is
100%,
yeah.
Yeah, because you're going to save money on dry cleaning, but you're not going to save money on travel because you're going to do more of that.
More
you're
going to
spoil the grandkids.
I'm going to learn to golf, Bill Geiger.
Yeah.
I'm going to do it.
Let's do this. It's been a while since I've been on. Let's do something special for our listeners today. Next five callers have a portfolio of $500,000 or up. We're going to sit down with them personally on a complimentary basis, help them put together a full-blown retirement plan. All the things we've been talking about today on a complimentary basis.
Bill Geiger, nice to see you again.
Good to see you, sir.
Thanks very much, David Jennings. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank. Thanks very much for tuning in, sitting in the Allstate Skyline studio this afternoon. It's not just a Thursday, you know. It's not just a beautiful spring Thursday. It's April 25th, and it turns out that is National DNA Day. Who knew, right? Well, Juliana Cintron knew, of course. She's from 23andMe, a trends expert there, and joins us on a phone line now. Juliana, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Okay, come on. What is National DNA Day? Where did this come from?
So it's celebrated on April 25th every year, and it commemorates both the successful completion of the Human Genome Project, which actually wasn't that long ago.
Right.
It happened in 2003, and also the description of the DNA's double helix by Watson and Crick, and that was in 1953, also not too long ago. We celebrate it, and we celebrate it here at the office.
I was going to say, and then it's a perfect marketing opportunity for outfits like 23andMe.
Definitely.
How's business? How are you guys doing? Is it saturated, or does it continue to grow?
It's been exponentially growing. We're at 10 million kits sold, so it's been great.
And why is it that people do it? I did a 23andMe a couple of years ago, and I did it only. I only bought the ancestry part of it. I didn't buy up for the health. And so am I in the majority there, or are people turning toward the health questions as well?
Yeah, so actually people turn for all sorts of reasons, right? People are really curious. They want to know more about themselves. People can find this information empowering, whether it's the ancestry or the health. It can lead to informed decisions, better lifestyle choices. But we actually conducted a survey nationwide, about 1,500 people. And three quarters of those people, about 75%, rank health information as their top interest for testing,
okay.
Which is a difference that we've seen. You know, mostly we have seen that people were really interested in finding out and learning about their ancestry.
Right. So it's starting to move toward health a little bit. Why do you think that is?
I think just accessibility, people having, you know, part of our mission here at 23andMe is to provide access to the human genome, and just having companies like ours that make it accessible and affordable to find out information about yourself. I think that's why people are really seeking this information out.
Well, okay, so let's say I get the health information, and what does that tell me, and then what would I do with it?
Sure. So we're a direct-to-consumer. We're the first and only direct-to-consumer genetic testing company that includes reports that have been authorized by the FDA. So to get that authorization, we had to prove over 99% accuracy. And the information that we can tell you is split up into two different categories. You have your genetic health risk report, which can tell you if you have a variant that puts you at a higher risk of developing a disease. And then our carrier status test, which tell you if you have a variant that you can pass on to your children. Now, it's important to keep in mind that we're not a diagnostic test.
Right.
So we're not telling you if you're definitely going to get a disease, just talking about that risk. And what we tell our customers, you know, within the reports and also if they contact us, is if they have questions about the information that they learn, they can seek out a genetic counselor. We link out to the National Society of Genetic Counselors within each report. And also just to contact their healthcare provider.
Well, Juliana, is there a situation where maybe I would get some health information there that would be actionable? I mean, there would be some certainty that perhaps maybe I shouldn't have children because I could pass this on, or is the guidance not that strong?
So we do have reports that are actionable, things like celiac disease, okay, and lactose intolerance. Those are reports that you know, we have, and they can be actionable because you can go and get further testing, confirmatory testing through a doctor. I had it myself for celiacs, and so, you know, if you have celiac disease and you don't want to eat gluten, if you're more likely to be lactose intolerant, then you want to stay away from dairy. So there are things that you can do to mitigate, you know, certain diseases.
I know there was a company up on the North Shore here in Chicago. In fact, they were on the show, and I took the test with them where they could do I think it was a DNA test, and ended up telling me which drugs would work best for me when it comes to diseases, or maybe which which popular prescription drugs would not work for me. Is that the sort of stuff you can get through a typical genetic testing?
So through 23andMe, we currently don't offer any reports on drug interactions.
Okay.
We did get authorization from the FDA, but it's not something that we currently offer. If we were to offer that in the future, we would let our customer base know. You would find that information on our website.
What kind of trends are there going? What are you moving for? What's in the future for 23andMe?
A lot of stuff. So one of our greatest components, in my opinion, is our research cohorts, and what that is over 80% of our customers participate in research. It's completely voluntary. You do have to opt into it, so it's your choice whether or not you want to participate. But you answer survey questions on our website, and what that does is it helps us make genetic associations. So some of our health reports actually are based on this research that we've been able to compile from answers we've gotten from our customers.
So if I volunteer the answers in my DNA, that adds to the database, if you will, and the database that helps you then with future testing, and then helps them make them more, right? The more people who are involved in this, then the more accurate they become.
Yeah, so with regards, you know, even just talking about the ancestry, as more people take the test, we'll be able to add to our reference populations.
Yeah.
And just touching back, sorry,
no,
just touching back on the health, you know, the survey that we conducted, we learned that Americans don't just want to learn about themselves. They also, you know, want to help others. And we found that 73% of the people that we surveyed were more likely to take a DNA test, like 23andMe, if they knew that this information could contribute to new discoveries, you know, leading to life-saving cures or treatments, et cetera.
Juliana, I was a little disappointed because I think my DNA test said I was 46% Irish and British. And if you're Irish, you don't want to be British. You need to separate those out.
Yeah, so that's a great thing to point out, and a common question that we get from customers. So the reason that those are grouped together is because they're too genetically similar for us to be able to tell them apart.
Right.
So we're looking at genetically similar groups, and we're assigning you a percentage based on that. Now, like you mentioned, the more people that take the test, we're going to be able to update those reference populations, hopefully, if we have enough information.
So that's because the British have been beating the hell out of the Irish for centuries, right?
No comment on that.
And so also, if you get my DNA, which you have now, I think, and could I eventually be charged for robbing Butler's department store in Manteno, Illinois in 1972?
Yeah, so law enforcement questions are something we get a lot. We don't voluntarily work with any law enforcement. We've successfully challenged the few requests that we've gotten over the years, and we haven't shared any data with law enforcement. We take your privacy really seriously. It's a top priority for the company. And if customers are interested, they can take a look at our transparency report online at 23andMe.com.
Well, you know, on the other side of it, though, and I was making a little joke, but there could be benefit to solving crimes with this data, but it's not something that you would ever consider sharing.
No, that's correct. Yes, we take, like I mentioned, we take our customers' privacy very seriously, and we don't share any of your genetic information.
Has law enforcement ever gone to court to try to get some of it, and what was the result of that?
So like I mentioned, we've successfully challenged any requests that we've gotten over the years. I don't know, privacy is not, my sector of expertise, so I don't know the exact number, but yeah, all of that information is available on our website.
Juliana Cintron is a 23andMe genetics trends expert, and you might be the only person I wish this to, so I want to say happy National DNA Day, Juliana.
Thank you very much. Happy National DNA Day to you as well.
It was great to talk to you. It's the Wintrust Business. Oops, I'm sorry, Juliana. Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't there a saying that goes like, from death comes life, or something like that? Well, that's the case at the old McDonald's HQ in Oak Brook, and the 17.5 acres are going to be living it up big. The plans for a new multi-use development have been approved. $500 million will go into making 250 apartments, 104 condos, a 252-room hotel, 3 restaurants, office space, retail locations, and a park that's about the size of a football field. The project is just starting up, so it'll be some time before it's all open. And soon, Uber will be open for trades on Wall Street when they file their IPO later this year with the help of a certain Chicago hedge fund. That hedge fund, Citadel, run by Chicago's very own billionaire Ken Griffin. It's one of the financial players chosen by the rideshare company to help them file this year, and it'll likely be the most anticipated filing of the year. Another feather in the cap for our business giants that make history every single day. Chicago rules! I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thanks very much, Orion Samuelson, Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. Okay, this Saturday is National Independent Bookstore Day. Today's National DNA Day. Who knew? But I did know about Independent Bookstore Day, and I'm excited about that. On a phone line to talk about it is Samantha Shea, who's the program director for Independent Bookstore Day. Samantha, welcome to the Biz Lunch.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So is this done through the ABA, or what's your host organization?
So I sort of do it independently, but okay. I am under the auspices of the Northern California Independent Booksellers Association, because we started in 2014 as a California event, and then we went national in 2015.
So not that long. It's a relatively new thing.
Yeah, this is our fifth year nationally. And we've grown from about 360 stores our first year to nearly 600 this year.
I know there's some here in the Chicago area as well. I have to tell you, do you have a list of the ones in Chicago taking place?
I hope I have them all, but I mean, there's a lot of them. There's the Bookseller, Volumes Book Cafe, Seminary Co-op, Bookends and Beginnings, Women and Children First.
I know. I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
You can go to chilovebooks.com, and there's all sorts of information about what Chicago's doing for Bookstore Day on Saturday, including their passport challenge.
You know, and I should tell you too, Samantha, I used to work for, well, not the enemy, but I was the host of Barnes & Noble's Meet the Writers for probably about 5 years in the early aughts, and I would, you know, I was,
Yeah, they're not the enemy.
No, I know. But they were the big...
They're just a fellow retailer with deeper pockets than most independents.
Well, but not as deep as they used to be. And I guess that's kind of where I'm getting at, you know. So I was there, I think, when they first started coming out with the Nook and they put the resources there. Anyway, I loved talking to the greatest writers of our time. It was just such a privilege and a thrill. But when Barnes & Noble and the other borders started to fade, that's when the independent bookstores, it seems to me, started to get a little bit of a resurgence. And they did it not just by selling books, but by people finally recognizing that in many ways, your local bookstore is a community center.
That's exactly right. I mean, what we always say is, look, we're not going to be able to compete on price with the big online retailers, and you know of whom I speak.
Right, right. And
we're not trying to. What independent bookstores offer is, like you said, a community center. They offer that third place for people. You know, it's not work, it's not home, but it's a gathering center. And they also reflect the communities where they are. And, of course, they can have author events, and you'll get a chance to meet and hear your favorite authors at Indies in a way you never could online.
Is that still going on? Because, when I used to interview the writers, a lot of times it would be from Chicago, but the authors have stopped traveling as much as they used to travel.
It's true that I don't think they send out as many, say, first-time novelists as they used to, but more established authors are traveling just as they always have. Our author ambassador this year for Independent Bookstore Day is Tayeri Jones, author of American Marriage, and she is out on a huge tour of independent bookstores for the paperback release of American Marriage. And there's just, if you look on the events page of any, you know, big independent bookstore, you'll see that there are authors coming through nearly every day of the week.
I used to love talking to the writers about their author appearances because it didn't matter how big they were. They all had horror stories about him. Because, you know, it's just amazing to talk to someone like Nora Roberts, you know, and she's like, well, yeah, I had one where nobody showed up. I mean, it's just, I just love stories like that. But how are sales?
If
you can't compete with price and you are competing with community, how are sales looking at independent bookstores?
Well, here's the good news. The good news is that many more independent bookstores have opened than have closed in the last 5 years. And there's a younger generation of booksellers opening brand new stores, taking over stores from people who are retiring, et cetera. Book sales are good. You know, it's not a massive growth industry, but they're chugging along. And, you know, we have... It goes up slightly every year on a month-to-month basis. You know, it's down, it's up, it's down, it's up. And those tiny little margins are where independent bookstores live.
And so it's sustainable, what you're saying, it's sustainable.
It's sustainable, oh yeah. And I think it's getting better. I mean, I just think, you know, as a part of the whole shop local movement that's happening in a lot of industries all over the country, bookstores have really been at the forefront of that. I think there's just a lot more knowledge about what any independent locally owned business does for a town or community. People understand that where they spend their money matters, and it will really make a difference in what their community ends up looking like.
Well, my favorite, closest local bookstore, independent bookstore to me is Lake Forest Bookstore. So I want to definitely give them a shout out, and hopefully people, I know there's great events there too. And I'm sure that they'll be busy on this Saturday as well.
Oh, yeah. The Chicago area is rich in wonderful independent bookstores.
Samantha Shea is one of the drivers behind it all. Thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.